Welcome to Counter Apologetics.
Welcome to Counter Apologetics. I'm your host, Emerson Green, and today we'll be discussing religion and child abuse. After a few weeks, higher-level patrons get to choose the subject of an episode, and listener Ayame chose the subject of religious child abuse and how it can find its roots in the Bible, and how some of it specifically relates to the fifth commandment to honor thy father and mother. After speaking back and forth, it seems like Ayame wants to shine a light on the Bible's lack of prohibition or even condemnation of child abuse, and how a religious upbringing can lead to serious problems in adulthood. So this will be more of a why religion is harmful than a why religion is untrue sort of episode, and just to be clear, since this episode is about how children are treated by religion, I need to give a content warning. We're going to be talking about religious child abuse and nothing will be sugarcoated, so I thought that should be made clear at the beginning. Is religion child abuse? There seems to be genuine controversy within the atheist community over this question, but before we argue over whether it is or isn't, we have to define religion, and we have to define child abuse. I think Matt Dillahunty gives a helpful clarification of terms here.
There's a couple of things that we need to kind of hit real quick, and one is that religion isn't one thing. Not all religious teachings are the same, and not all religious teachings have the same impact. The same thing is true for child abuse. It doesn't always take on the same forms or have the same degree of consequences. Beating or raping a child, I mean, those are clear examples of child abuse, but there's mental abuse as well. Yeah. But it is a form of child abuse. For the people who are saying that claiming some religious indoctrination is child abuse is watering it down, they simply don't understand the impact that people can have on children in their formative years. So it's just kind of absurd to me that people would think that religion needs to be one thing, child abuse needs to be only one thing, and the punishment for child abuse needs to be only one thing. There's a broader spectrum here. And while I do not claim that all religious teaching of children is necessarily child abuse, a great quantity of it is, to varying degrees.
I think much of the controversy surrounding this question could be cleared up by acknowledging that, for one, there are gradations of abuse in any context, religious or not, and not all abuse is equal, but that doesn't mean that it's not abuse. Children can be abused physically, sexually, or psychologically, and there are gradations within those categories. Some people have claimed that calling religion child abuse is hyperbolic and disrespectful to victims of other forms of child abuse, and I disagree with this for a couple of reasons. For one, I think there are different forms of abuse and there's no reason to discuss which is worse or compare them. Secondly, there are things that we would all recognize as abuse that are directly caused by religion. And I've also been in conversation with people who were raised religiously who consider themselves to be victims of abuse. And personally, I'm not entirely comfortable looking at someone who says they were abused as a child and replying, "No, you weren't. What you're describing isn't really child abuse." I think we should listen to the people raised in fundamentalist contexts and consider what they have to say. It's obvious that not all religious upbringings are tantamount to abuse, but it's equally obvious that some of them are. There are clear cases like those of child brides, acid attacks, or denying basic medical care for religious reasons, but there are more subtle examples as well. So before we look at the more specific instances of religious child abuse, let's take a step back and look at the Christian text. What does the Bible have to say about this sort of behavior? We can start with the status of children.
Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee.
This is reaffirmed along with other Old Testament law in all its glory by Jesus in the New Testament in Matthew 15:3-4. Quote, Jesus replied, "And why do you, by your traditions, violate the direct commandments of God? For instance, God says, honor your father and mother, and anyone who speaks disrespectfully of their father and mother must be put to death." End quote. And just to be perfectly clear, that's Jesus berating his listeners for not killing their disobedient children. Jesus really said that. But as for the fifth commandment itself, there are endless mystical apologetics for the glaring lack of nuance in this law. There's no caveat that says, honor your parents, unless they're abusive. There's no reciprocal, honor your parents and parents honor your children. There's only, obey your parents, full stop. If they abuse you physically, sexually, or psychologically, well, that's just not addressed. It's an explicitly authoritarian commandment where children are expected to obey their parents, with no caveat explaining that the rule is void if the parents abuse their power. The Bible is a long book. There's plenty of room for clarification of this command, but there isn't one because the author didn't intend for there to be one. So on the internet, there's as much rationalization and justification of God's words here as you can stomach. The sad thing is that most of it seems to have been written by people who were abused and are trying to understand why God forgot to condemn child abuse in his book, but included an authoritarian demand on children. In Proverbs 13:24, it says, "He who spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves him is careful to discipline him." So, spare the rod, spoil the child is also lacking in nuance as it doesn't offer any details about when it's okay to beat your kids or how much. It just says, in general, beat your kids if you care about them, and offers no further clarification. I think that when instructing full-grown adults to physically beat their children with sticks, it's important to be clear what you mean. James Dobson, founder of Focus on the Family, wrote The Strong-Willed Child and Dare to Discipline, whose sole purpose was to get parents to beat their children. And it was extremely successful. Michael and Debbie Pearl wrote a book about how to biblically discipline your child and systematically use the rod. And I'm going to quote from the New York Times. "More than 670,000 copies of the Pearls' self-published book are in circulation, and it is especially popular among Christian homeschoolers, who praise it in their magazines and on their websites. The Pearls provide instructions on using a switch from as early as 6 months old to discourage misbehavior." End quote. The reason these people were being covered in the New York Times was because they were tied to several deaths of children. A string of parents who had beaten their children to death all had the Pearls book to train up a child. One child had died from a specific whipping practice that was outlined in the book. Returning to the Bible, there's the story of Abraham and Isaac, where a man very nearly stabs a child to death and burns his remains because voices in his head told him to. God told Abraham to commit human sacrifice using his son to see if Abraham would submit. God rewarded Abraham because of his display of obedience, which again was to be willing to murder his son because of a voice in his head. Isaac, of course, had no say in this. Abraham didn't tell him what his intentions were, even when Isaac asked where the sacrificial animal was. It only says that Abraham tied Isaac to the altar and doesn't elaborate on the conversation between the two of them, but if Isaac was willing, I don't see why he needed to be restrained. And for all the apologists who say that Abraham didn't actually kill Isaac, there's a similar story where the human sacrifice is carried out. In Judges 11, Jephthah makes a deal with God to sacrifice to him the first living thing that comes out of his house when he comes home, if God helps him win a battle. Jephthah wins the battle, and his daughter is the first one to come out of his house when he returns, and he sacrifices his daughter. God watches this and doesn't stop the human sacrifice. And of course, God must have known in his omniscience that Jephthah's daughter would be the one sacrificed, and he still made the deal and saw that it was carried out. So, as to my original question, what is the status of children according to the Bible? I think the answer is clear. If you read the Bible honestly, children are property and parents are their owners. They can beat them, lie to them, miseducate them, control them in every area, and kill them if they see fit. The Bible doesn't just justify child abuse, though it does provide many ready-made justifications for just about anything you want. It also causes child abuse that wouldn't have happened otherwise. It's not hard to trace the intellectual roots of the text to the real-world behavior. And yes, there are some sick people who will cause harm and justify their abuse with religion. But there are normal parents who only abuse their children because of their religion. You need religion to make psychologically normal parents abuse their children. Beliefs cause behavior, and if you're going to be a fundamentalist, the fundamentals of your religion really do matter. The fact is that the Bible never condemns child abuse. It never even uses the phrase child abuse or any analog, which doesn't exactly make me think it was a priority in anyone's mind. There's not even any direct mention of pedophilia, let alone a condemnation of it. Psychological abuse is all but mandated, and physical abuse is explicitly encouraged. People care about child abuse, and of course religious people do as well. And the fact that there is no mention of it in the Bible should be proof enough that we don't get this concern for children from God's perfect book of morality. Our concern for the well-being of children is innate. It comes from within us. It's not even mentioned in the central text of Christianity, let alone condemned. Some Christians try to point to the story where Jesus wanted the children to come to him. I've often heard Jesus' words paraphrased by believers along the lines of, "It would be better to hang a millstone around your neck in the sea than hurt a child." But this is not what Jesus said. He said in Luke 17:2, quote, "It would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were cast into the sea, than that he should cause one of these little ones to sin," end quote. Some translations say stumble instead of sin, and the King James Version says not to offend one of these little ones. But the Greek word offend means to cause to stumble or entice into sin. So this is clearly not a condemnation of hurting children, this is a condemnation of enticing children into Jesus' definition of sin. And don't forget Matthew 15:3-4, where Jesus admonishes his followers for being soft on applying the death penalty to children for the crime of being disobedient. You might be tempted to say the majority of religious people aren't abusive to children, but that's debatable, and it's not any comfort to those being beaten, raped, lied to, or denied some of the best things about life. Even if only a small percentage of religious people abused their children, we would still be talking about hundreds of millions of people. And it's no comfort to the people being abused that what's happening to them is statistically improbable. And I'm not convinced that it is. Starting at a very young age, children are terrified with images of hell. I was lucky enough to not be afraid of hell as soon as I became an atheist, but not everyone is so fortunate. There are many atheists who still feel fear at the thought of hell. What is especially perverse about this is that believers will point to this fear as evidence that they still believe deep down. Fear is instinctual, and the nature and benefit of instinct is that it motivates you without the aid of reason. So this fear was programmed into a small child when they had no hope of evaluating what they were being told. They carry this conditioned fear into adulthood, and then their abusers point to the fear as evidence. There is absolutely no evidence that there is any afterlife, let alone the Christian hell. And yet parents seem to feel perfectly justified in causing serious distress to small children who trust their word and believe everything they say. Here, Richard Dawkins tells a story of a correspondence with a victim of psychological and sexual abuse.
There are shades of being abused by a priest, and I quoted the example of a woman in America who wrote to me saying that when she was 7 years old, she was sexually abused by a priest in his car, and at the same time, a friend of hers, who also seven, who was Protestant, or was of Protestant family, I should say, died. And she was told that because her friend was Protestant, she had gone to hell and would be roasting in hell forever. And she told me that of those two abuses, she got over the physical abuse. It was yucky, but she got over it. But the mental abuse of being told about hell, she took years to get over. It seems to me that telling children such that they really, really believe that people who sin are going to go to hell and roast forever, forever, it seems to me to be intuitively entirely reasonable that that is a worse form of child abuse.
In case you've never heard of hell houses, they are attractions where young children are walked through a haunted house that depicts the tortures of hell and the kinds of activities that can get you there. These activities include having premarital sex, being gay, getting an abortion, believing in evolution, and other sins. Actors create the image of what hell is going to be like, complete with fire, screaming, and sinners being tortured. The tactic of these ministries is to use fear to convert children.
Pastor Keenan Roberts is rehearsing a new production of his Colorado-based Hell House, which he's written and staged for almost 15 years.
Every scene preaches the truth that either sin destroys or Jesus saves.
We're gonna hurt people! You're hurting me!
Chrissy, it's only a medical procedure.
No! No, I changed my mind!
It's just too bad! I wasn't there the night you were born!
Good.
Well, over the years of having audiences and people go through this, we have come to the decision that the best age for young people is really at 12.
You see, killing babies is such a wonderful choice.
In the case of homosexual marriage, what harm does that do? Why would you be so passionately against that?
They're living in sin. I want them to know homosexuality is sin.
But you believe it presumably on the basis of scriptural authority. You believe
absolutely.
Yeah.
Unapologetically.
Yes, unapologetically. But why are you so sure that's right? I mean, it's their decision.
Opinion. It's not my opinion. I'm telling you what the Bible says.
It's the Bible's opinion, but these are two people who want to live together. Isn't it their own business? What right have you to interfere?
This woman and this woman burning in a repulsive lust for one another, deceived by all of hell that they've been born gay, are joining their deeply confused lives in this nauseating matrimony.
The whole model is based on using fear to influence children. These appeals to fear can be effective. I've been presented with Pascal's Wager enough times to realize that believers are absolutely terrified of hell. This fear is cultivated when people are at their most vulnerable, as children. And like so many other things in religion, this belief is imposed on children who don't have the intellectual capacity to critically evaluate what they're being told. Then those kids grow up and ask me Pascal's Wager. Moving away from hell, another potential category of abuse would be intellectual abuse. There is an entire parallel universe in Christian schools and in the Christian homeschooling community. They have their own textbooks and their own facts that almost never come into contact with reality. And teaching kids anti-critical thinking skills is obviously damaging, and denying kids a real education about the world doesn't exactly set them up for success in life.
People who are teaching their children the sort of anti-critical thinking skills and dogmatic assertions about religion are compromising their children's mental immune system and making them susceptible to abuse, to cons, to an overdependence and reliance upon authority figures. I'm just baffled that people can think that this isn't somehow harmful. The fallacies that are used to bolster religion are harmful to a developing individual's brain because it sets up a barrier between them and an actual discovery of reality. It prevents them from exercising critical thinking skills.
Religion has a troubled history with sex, and the indoctrination and repression starts early. I think a lot of psychological abuse is committed as a result of religious anxiety about sex and an obsession with purity. Children are taught that sexual impulses are immoral and evil in almost all contexts, if you think about it. Of course, the exception being in the case of marital sex, which, to be fair, some fundamentalists are very enthusiastic about. But I don't know of any mainstream religion that is even remotely sex positive outside of heterosexual marital sex. I'm not saying that religious fundamentalists are hopelessly repressed in all regards, not at all. I'm just pointing to the fact that the traditional evangelical sex ed plan is less than optimal in terms of healthy psychological and sexual development. I would say that it causes so many unnecessary problems and so much distress as to warrant serious scrutiny, especially since young children are the primary recipients. The atheist YouTuber Lacey Green, who deconverted from Mormonism, thought that the way religion treats sex was so dysfunctional and such a barrier to human flourishing that she took it upon herself to become a sex educator to try to counteract it, and her channel is linked in the show notes. Abstinence-only sex education, another gift from religion, is not effective. It doesn't delay the first sexual experience, and it doesn't reduce teen pregnancy. I have links in the show notes which include a federally funded 2007 study where four abstinence-only programs were evaluated and these conclusions were reached. Numerous studies have corroborated these findings, and yet, thanks to Christian prudishness and anxiety about sex, we've spent nearly $2 billion in the last couple decades on a program we know doesn't work, and to add insult to injury, tells children that if they have sex before marriage, they're like a piece of gum that's already been chewed. Many religious parents teach their children that homosexuality is a sin. Leviticus clearly states that homosexuality is an abomination to God, and it's also condemned as a sin in the New Testament. LGBT people who were raised religious can have a hard time shaking off this indoctrination and having relationships with no sense of self-consciousness or simply not feeling guilt or embarrassment for their sexual impulses. There is an abnormally large teenage homeless population around Salt Lake City because Mormon parents kick their kids out of the house if they find out they're gay. There are endless stories of being ostracized from family and losing relationships for nothing more than not being heterosexual. Also, not all religious people are against marriage equality, but if you're against gay marriage, you are almost certainly a religious person. I have one more thing to say about religion and sex, and I'm probably going to irritate some listeners, but I'm also including circumcision in this episode. This is an example of something that we would not be doing right now if it weren't for religion. And if mutilating the genitals of infants for religious reasons doesn't count as religious child abuse, I'm not sure what would. Some people incorrectly argue that circumcision has great medical benefits, but the evidence is extremely limited and dubious for a number of reasons. The most common claim is that circumcision helps reduce the spread of HIV, and according to the World Health Organization, it's almost 60% effective. But using a condom is 99% effective, and it doesn't require any non-consensual medical procedures. The claim is also made that some forms of cancer are less statistically frequent in the circumcised population, and though this conclusion is disputed, it doesn't actually matter. Even if genital mutilation reduced your risk of cancer, why not just let adults decide if they want to do it? Consenting adults can do whatever they want. If they're convinced by that reasoning, then they can get circumcised. It should go without saying that all these medical benefits were desperately searched for by the researchers after the fact. As time has gone on, defenders of genital mutilation have tried to find justifications for their tradition, and the best conclusive reason they could find was that it's about half as effective as a condom at preventing the spread of HIV. Many of the basic arguments used in support of male circumcision can also be used in support of female genital mutilation. Muslim apologists argue that female genital mutilation reduces cervical cancer, but I don't think that justifies the practice either, for the same reasons circumcision isn't justified by benefits, real or exaggerated. Even many atheists haven't shaken off this part of their indoctrination. Religious people are literally mutilating the genitals of infants, and I'm sure there are listeners who are mad at me right now for pointing that out. Even if there were some medical benefits, you can't just mutilate someone's genitals without their consent. Think about what I just had to say because of religion. You can't just mutilate someone's genitals without their consent. This absurdly obvious statement only needs to be said because of religion.
Christopher, I've got to call you down on referring to circumcision as genital mutilation. My son cried more at his first haircut than he did at his bris.
A person as humane as yourself can sit here and think of that as a fit subject for humor shows what I mean. Religion makes morally normal people say and do disgusting and wicked things, and you've just proved my point for me. Shame on you for saying what you just said. Shame on you for saying it about your own son, my God. What next? Cutting the labia of little girls. At least Judaism doesn't do that.
This is a question.
What if a Muslim was to say to you just now, my little girl cried more at her first haircut than when I cut off her clitoris? What would you think of me if I was to say such a disgusting thing?
Well,
genital mutilation is no joke.
So as to the question, is religion child abuse? The correct answer is that it depends what you mean by religion. Some practices within religion are absolutely child abuse, but we should always be precise with our language to capture the nuances and refrain from black and white thinking. But we should also be careful not to minimize the suffering of many children who were raised religious and not succumb to the social taboo against criticizing religion. It's also difficult to talk about religious child abuse when you know there are parents listening who did these things, even if only because their pastor and James Dobson told them to. I think the social prohibition against criticizing religion is also partially to blame for the fact that most states in the US have some sort of religious exemption for child abuse and even manslaughter for when children are denied medical care or beaten to death for religious reasons. But I think that even atheists are not totally immune to the taboo against criticizing religion, and that may explain why so many are hesitant to even bring up the subject of religion and child abuse. Those are all the counter-apologetics I have for you today. Thanks to Ayame for picking the subject of today's show. I need to thank Al from South Carolina for becoming a new patron. Thank you, Al, and thank you to all my patrons who make the show possible. You can support this show on a per-episode basis at patreon.com/counter, where you can earn early access to every episode in addition to many other benefits. If you don't have the money to support on Patreon, but you still want to keep the Christ out of Christmas, you can like us on our social media or leave a 5-star review on iTunes or wherever you can. Our theme music was written and performed by the band Wailers. The song is called Magic Tricks and was used with permission. Thank you for joining me today. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll see you next time we meet to Counter Apologetics.